Hi, I'm Jeff Furillo and you're listening to the Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century on Radio Skid Row 88.9 FM. The Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century is a weekly program for older Australians where we talk about ageing well. And every week, we'll talk about the issues that affect us as we age, right here and right now.
It happens every day. I should think of the present, 'cause the present's now. Well, I remember when I was young, how one trip that's got you to the movies.
Later in Nostalgia Town, we'll be talking to former West Australian Premier Jeff Gallop about his formative cultural experiences growing up in Geraldton in Western Australia. In our next episode, we'll hear from BP Pick-a-Box champion and former Australian Science Minister Barry Owen Jones. Before the end of the discussion, we'll be speaking with Inner West Council Healthy Ageing Supervisor Mary Chanter about what's going on for older people in Sydney's Inner West. But first things first, today, we are going to discuss Aboriginality and ageing with Barbara O'Neill, and then with my two studio guests here on the Punters panel. Our guest today is Aboriginal worker at the Junction Neighbourhood Centre at Maroubra, Barbara O'Neill, who was born on the Gadigal country. Good afternoon, Barbara. How are you today?
Hey, Jeff. How are you?
Thank you so much for joining us today. And what are the issues that are facing older Aboriginal people as they age in Australia?
One of the things that I like to make clear when I talk about Aboriginal communities is each community is unique and individual. So I can only talk about the community that I work in. The community I work in, what I'm finding is that we get a lot of disconnected people, people that have had to leave their country for various reasons or don't live with their own community, which is local, for various reasons. So they lose that connection to family and to the broader community that they may have grown up in. So they find themselves in suburban Sydney and they find that they are socially isolated because they stay in their units. They all have social housing estates. What happens is because of aberrant behaviour by some tenants, Aboriginal tenants the older people tend to stay inside the unit and not emerge from it. They might go out just to step to see Centrelink or they might go out to do some shopping, but we're finding that they're not socially active. They're very socially isolated.
So loneliness and isolation is a big factor for older Aboriginal people around Maroubra.
Yes. If unless they are connected with their extended family. I'm talking about people who are probably in their 50s onwards. There's the health issues as well, but there tends to be very poor health in the age group from 50 onwards. And even though they may seemingly be okay, there's chronic health conditions underlying, and that can also cause anxiety and depression. And they don't want to really spend a lot of time with other people. They may see some of their own family, but it's usually in a caring role or in a caretaker role. They're not getting access, being stimulated in their own age group, in their own cohort. And also they have an absolute historical fear of services, especially in those age groups, because a lot of them have been impacted by the Stolen Generation and the Aboriginal Act and what have you. So they really don't trust services or hospitals. And it's a major challenge for us to come up with strategies that can help them to overcome the very real fear of services and hospitals. It takes a while with Aboriginal people to let you in. For instance, someone may have come from the mid-north coast. That is a completely different culture to the one in Maroubra. So it takes time for them, because even though we're a non-government organisation and not-for-profit neighbourhood centre, to them we are still a service. And until I can develop that relationship with them and let them know that I'm walking on the journey beside them, I'm not telling them how to walk. I'm just there to let them know what's around. Until they can trust me to that degree, we don't make many inroads.
So how do you go about breaking down that kind of a barrier?
Yeah, it's pretty tough. We've got some really great outreach workers. They work across all cultures, right? And they go down and they will have, if there's a community room on one of the housing estates, they will open it up and just be there, just have a presence. And if, as people wander in, they might start having a talk. And then if the outreach workers identify that there's something they can help them with, they'll offer that help. We have barbecues where we just put on a barbecue and we might do it month after month after month. But this is what you do. People have to know you're going to come back. The biggest problem is services don't go back. They give up. There's simple strategies like that, Jeff. Just being there.
And are you finding that things are gradually changing or are they pretty stable? Do people remain suspicious?
Yes, some people do. My speciality is trauma work. And I've found that unless you can get them to trust you to the point where subjects that could be triggering can be discussed, some people won't ever move out of their comfort zone, or should I say their safety zone. But some people, once they trust you and once they realise that you're always going to be there and you're not going away and that it's not just a pop in to tick boxes, then they start actually warming up to you. And when they do, you find that they normally become really proactive with you in the community. And the thing is, you can't go in and think that you're the one that's going to save the world. You go in thinking, I wonder if there's someone out there that just needs to be reassured that it's, hey, it's okay to come out and talk. It's okay to use services. Like everyone in Australia uses one service or another. So, you know, let's get you back into using services and back into being supported.
You mentioned that plenty of people you see have experiences of being stolen. Is it a great number?
Yes, it is, Jeff. At this stage in our history, there's not one family that hasn't been impacted by the stolen generation. And I say that very seriously and sadly. No matter who you speak to in an Aboriginal family, it's probably one generation, two generations away from being impacted by it.
And we have this intergenerational trauma.
And what happens is, when you've got the intergenerational trauma, the minute you're born, the minute you conceive, the cut is there from the intergenerational trauma. So that means that once you're born and you start going through life, every time you access a service and you have a bad experience, that just opens that cut again. People aren't aware of it. They just know that they feel really uncomfortable accessing a service and they feel anxious and they feel rejected. So they just think, no, I'll just do it on my own. It's that repeated opening of the wound, that repeated cutting that is doing the damage.
So how are attitudes to ageing among Aboriginal people different from the broader Australian community?
In the broader community, so I straddle both communities, I know there's a huge disadvantaged pocket of non-Aboriginal older people, but there are more mainstream Australians with their own property than there ever would be Aboriginal people in the same age group. Shelter has always been something that Aboriginal people have had to since colonisation, have had to rely on various governments to ensure that they had. There was always an Aboriginal working class, but it was always suppressed as soon as it got up. So our opportunities to have our own homes in this generation were very, very, very effectively suppressed.
Hi, I'm Lex Marinos, and you're listening to the Baby Boomers' Guide to Life in the 21st Century on 88.9 FM Radio Skid Row. Get connected and stay connected.
You're as good as a Viking. He is very handy with a sword. He does nothing better.
We're speaking with Barbara O'Neill, Aboriginal worker in the Junction Neighbourhood Centre in Maroubra. Barbara goes on to talk about the different experiences of ageing between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Australians.
The difference between the Aboriginal and the broader community's ageing experiences, the Aboriginal community is dealing with transgenerational trauma. The Aboriginal community that is in the age brackets now that we're speaking of, older Australians, most of them would have been removed or had a mother or been removed from their mothers or their mother would have been removed from their mother. It is highly likely, absolutely highly likely, that this cohort are the ones that were directly affected from the stolen generation.
I've spoken to both Susan Ryan, who was Australia's first age discrimination commissioner, and with Linda Burney. Susan Ryan says that Australia is ageist. Linda agrees, but she says that it's not nearly so much a problem in Aboriginal communities where respect for older people is much more embedded in the culture. Do you find that?
Oh, yes. I'm 67 this year, and I find that even the wildest young Aboriginal people, if I'm walking down the street or in any environment whatsoever, they'll stop whatever they're doing and just nod and say, "Hi, Aunt," or just put their heads down because they've been playing up. It's very, very, very rare that I ever experience disrespect from an Aboriginal younger person. In the Aboriginal community, it is a natural reaction is to respect older people. It is something that is embedded in the psyche. It's almost spiritual. Oh, it's a lovely feeling because I walk in those communities. I feel so safe in an Aboriginal community. I know I'm going to be respected and someone's going to have my back.
It sounds admirable and it sounds like something worth aspiring to in the broader community of older people.
You talk to younger people and they actually look you in the eye and listen. They engage. It's something that broader Australia could aspire to, quite frankly. And I think it's because historically, in Aboriginal communities, the older people have held the stories. The older people have the knowledge. The older people have been the healers. And so we're only 250 years away from colonisation. And we have been around for 65,000 years. So we've had a long time to develop that.
So, Barbara, what services exist to meet the needs of older Aboriginal people?
Okay, the best services are those run by Aboriginal organisations. And I say that because there's been much research done on this, and organisations that are not Aboriginal but serve this Aboriginal community, there are breakdowns in culture and in expectation. When it's an Aboriginal-run organisation, they understand what I just spoke to you about older people. They understand that they have this deep knowledge that they are holding within them. It's the sacred of being older. They understand that and get that. So all of their interactions are informed by that. So we've got Wyanga at Redfern. They're a very good Aboriginal Age Services organisation. And we've also got Gurawal out at La Perouse. I don't know about any others because I'm focused on those areas. The information's out there. I know Mount Druitt has a very, very good program, and some of the country towns have very, very good ones. And these all work. They have been evidence-based. They have been researched, and they work. They really do. What they achieve is number one, trust. Having said that, just because it's an Aboriginal organisation does not necessarily mean it's naturally going to be okay. They have to work at gaining the trust as well. But once they do, the ones that have been evidence, that are evidence-based and been researched, you look at what they do differently. For instance, they consult with the older people. They don't rush the older people. They sit down and yarn with them. The older people are able to say what they would like to happen. It's community-directed. When it comes to dealing with the government side of all organisations and the paperwork and what have you, they explain it to them. And they reassure them that they're not signing themselves away to be taken into one of those white institutions where they may disappear like their mothers did and their grandmothers did before them. There's a big history in Australian hospitals. The health profession's trying desperately to reverse this. But what used to happen was, supposing a mum might be sick and she has to go to hospital, this is only up to the 60s, a woman may be sick and go to hospital. When she came back out, her children would have been removed for being neglected. Even though they weren't, she was in hospital and other people in the community were keeping an eye on them, those children were removed. So Aboriginal people have this fear of hospitals, that once you go into hospital, the rest of your family is going to be impacted by negative events.
How ghastly that must be.
Yes, and this is it. And we're, because we have a large burden of chronic illness, our people aren't accessing hospitals for those reasons. So these Aboriginal care organisations are a fantastic bridge between that historic event and subsequent fear and the support that they actually need in our fabulous Australian health system.
So, Barbara, is ageing for older Aboriginal people something to be dreaded, or is it something to be embraced?
It depends. If you're living a very urban life like my clients, and you're accessing non-Aboriginal services, and you're not going through specific Aboriginal channels, I would say that it'd be just as burdensome as it is for non-Aboriginal people. There wouldn't be much difference between being Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal. If you live in a community or you live in a traditional Aboriginal community, the chances are that you're going to be valued and treasured. So there are some communities where alcoholism and drug use has overrode that respect, and older people are scared and they're very frightened. In the broader community, it is a very respectful thing to grow older. It's a natural occurrence. It's like a tree. A tree gets bigger and stronger, and that's how Aboriginal older people are seen, as an icon in their community.
Barbara O'Neill, Aboriginal worker at the Junction Neighbourhood Centre at Maroubra, thank you for joining us today on the Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century.
Okay, thank you very much.
And now it's time for the Punters Panel, where we speak with local older people about the issue of the day. And in the studio today, I have Lucille McKenna, a councillor with the Inner West Council, Lucille McKenna OAM, and Agnes Ware, a Torres Strait Islander community member, who is also a Radio Skid Row presenter of the Koori Connections program each Tuesday on 10 to 12. Well, that was a great chat from Barbara O'Neill. And it seems to me that the key message is that the experience of ageing for Aboriginal people is the stain of the trauma of childhood, of the removal of children. What can you tell us about that, Agnes?
Well, as a Torres Strait Islander, we Torres Strait Islanders, our families that grew up with trauma during the times in the islands, because we have to travel by boat to and from each island, and one of the where the hospital is, the hospital is situated on one island, and you have to travel sometimes 1 hour by dinghy to from a remote island to the mainland, which is Thursday Island, and that's the only place that it has a hospital. Today, which is, I'm really excited to say that they've actually built an elder's home on Thursday Island, so the elders can regularly visit the hospital. Yep. Usually, if some of the elders that sometimes don't want to go anywhere near the hospital because the doctors are strange to them, they're strangers and they're white people, and so they don't trust white people.
And what we have with you, Lucille, is somebody with a lot of experience working in health, but of a non-Aboriginal background. You and I both work in health as nurses, and we're used to being trusted. It is a bit of it's a bit confronting to realise it's not like that.
It is very confronting because nurses, as we know, are the most trusted profession and have been ever since those statistics have been taken on an annual basis. They come out as the most trusted. And here we have a whole group of our community who are not trusting of those services that are there available to them. It is quite distressing. What I was wondering is if... I know there's been considerable effort made to try and increase the number of Aboriginal health professionals. Is that working and is that helping to address this issue?
Yes, it's finally helping, and the New South Wales government is involved as well, educating our people to, in recruitment. So we're... All the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people now are getting into the New South Wales government agencies, and there's a lot of people that have joined the health department. And when an elder sees somebody that, you know, from your country, they live a little bit longer, and they like to express themselves to you as well.
Yeah,
say, wow, you know, it's really exciting to see somebody from your country or your village or wherever you're from, that's a nurse or a doctor. And we've had so many successes.
Don't
have that much doctors or nurses, but I just want to encourage all the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people out there, you know, if you into the into health, or if you can stand the sight of blood, well, join up.
That's an interesting...
And help your grandmother.
that is an interesting comment, because as a nurse... and I'm sure Jeff would agree that people say, oh, I hate the sight of blood. You actually don't see a lot of blood. You know, it's not something that you actually see on a daily basis. So it's more about having some empathy with people, having compassion, caring about humanity. They're the key things. And, of course, that's something that that in our Aboriginal community is there, because they do care about each other, and they're so being part of community is such a strong belief for them. So, you know, being able to transfer those skills, especially to nursing, is wonderful. And but I appreciate the difficulty of finding those sort of specific healthcare workers, but it seems like it's one of those things that's really important. The other thing that is a concern, of course, is the fact that many of these people's life experience and is such that their life expectancy is so much shorter. And we really need to be doing as much as we can to try and help them and assist them. I did talk earlier, before the show, we were chatting about the importance of socialising as well as the health issues. It's the most important thing now that a lot of the research is telling us. So it was sad to hear that they don't like to leave their homes in the people that the person that was talking today. So... that seems to me something that would enjoy, because again that community and that communal living experience, which is traditional for them. So how can we go there?
And one of the things that really struck me, because I've now heard it a few times, is that the experience of older people within the community of respect and regard is quite different to what we see. We had Susan Ryan talking about becoming invisible as you age, and yet both Linda Burney and now Barbara O'Neill talking about how as an older person you get respected, your dignity is respected. This is something to aspire to.
It's cultural and it's traditional, and we Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have to respect our elders, because That's our parents as well, our grandparents. So if you respect your mother and father, you have to do that to the, all your whole family. I'm from a family of 10, and my parents has got from a family of 10. My father has 7, 8 boys in his family, and they're all my uncles and aunties, and their grandparents. So can you imagine how many grandparents I got?
Pretty extended by the sound of it.
Yeah, so it's the same situation here in Sydney as well. And I grew up down the block, so, you know, look, I tell you what, even the junkies, they have respect for the elders down the block. I've seen them do that. And that they will ask you politely, they will leave you politely, they will never... disrespect you whatsoever, you know, and then they'll say hello, and then all of a sudden run up the road and go, yeah, you know, start shouting and carrying on. But they would never do that in front of the elders.
No,
yeah,
no. It certainly is something to be applauded, that respect. But I personally have found with younger people, if you treat them with respect, they'll usually. Respond
usually
appropriately. Usually. I mean, very rarely have I had any problems myself with younger people. But I think if you have that within you to be really respectful and have empathy for people's situation, that really is terribly important.
So I suppose it's best that you don't walk into a social situation expecting that you'll get respect.
That's right, yes.
And there are a lot of places now that I remember back in the day when I used to DJ for the elders. I did that voluntarily. I went to the actual home, but I had to collect a lot of old music. That was fun. And they'd get up and start dancing with each other.
Right.
And that's what's missing is socialising.
The socialising, yes, and that was probably the saddest part of that, because you know when you get older and when you have a little more time, you've raised your families, you may be retired. That's the time when you should be able to do some of those things where you can socialise a little bit more and enjoy yourself.
They should go out. You know, there's a lot of places available for the elders that you can visit and go out. But, you know, we may need other organisations or start a new one to do something specific like that.
Yeah, but sometimes people need a lot of encouragement as well because I'm a very confident person, but I've found since I've retired I've had to engage in new things and new activities, and you have to be fairly confident and resilient to join in a group or, you know, even a couple of you. So I understand that for them it can be very difficult. So I think we probably as a community could be doing more to really fill some of those voids, especially on the social experience, whether it be, you know, playing sports and things for older people or games. And there's lots of things that could be happening, but you know.
And it's good for the mind for them as well, you know.
Like,
you know, I think in America they give them puppies and live animals to play with or cuddle, or they try something very new all the time.
Well, look, thank you very much, my guests, Lucille McKenna and Agnes Ware, for joining us today on the Punters Panel. I think it's been a fascinating topic, and it's been a real insight to listen to Barbara O'Neill and to hear you two speaking together. Thank you once again very much. And now for the segment of the show that we call Nostalgia Town, where we talk to well-known older Australians about the musical, the theatrical and the film experiences that helped make them the people they are today.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh.
Our guest on Nostalgia Town today is Jeffrey Gallop, AC. Jeffrey is Professor and Director of the Graduate School of Government at the University of Sydney and former Chairman of the Australian Republican Movement. Geoffrey was the 27th Premier of Western Australia. He grew up in Geraldton in Western Australia and later progressed to St John's College at the University of Oxford after winning a Rhodes Scholarship. Welcome to Nostalgia Town, Geoff Gallop. How are you today?
Very well. We've had a wonderful string of summer-type days here in Sydney. The water's very warm, so it's wonderful.
Geoff Gallop, what were your formative cultural experiences as you were growing up?
Well, I guess I lived in a family that wasn't, you know, inclined towards reading lots of books. My father and mother did read a bit, but not a lot. I wouldn't call it an intellectual-type family, but very focused on sport, local community. You know, it sort of took me out into that local community very much, particularly with football, that's AFL football in the winter, and cricket, which I was quite a good player in the summer. But school, of course, was where I got intellectual stimulation. My parents really wanted to encourage me at schoolwork. And so I had two wonderful lives, really. There was, you know, Monday to Friday, schoolwork, getting stimulated, writing, learning new things. In fact, life is a learning process as far as I'm concerned. That's how we should look at it. And then the weekend, sport. And my great ambition as a youngster was to be a sports commentator. I used to practice quite a lot. As it turned out, of course, it didn't happen.
Tell me now about things like radio and music.
Oh, I love radio. I mean, I lived in Geraldton, which is, you know, about 400 kilometres north of Perth. It's a major port for the rural and minerals hinterland. Also a very big fishing industry with the Abrolhos Islands, major exporter of rock lobster. And it was a wonderful place to grow up in. I was very, very fortunate to be listening to ABC Radio. I remember my favourite program was the weekly play. They would always have a play on. I used to always listen. It was always an interesting play. And then on Sunday evening, they had the English comedians used to come on. Round the Horn, Kenneth Horne, a great English comedian. I used to always enjoy listening to that. So radio, when the sports results were coming on, it'd be tuned on. So really growing up, the major cultural influence, without any doubt, was the ABC, the plays that it used to put on to listen to, and its sporting coverage, you know, second to none.
And did you get away on a Saturday for the matinee at the movies?
Friday night. We all went to the movies, and we used to queue up and go in, and there was a wonderful man called Paddy Doolan who was had the torch. And, of course, one of the great games was to, you know, roll the Maltesers down, and he always catch up on people. But I remember all the movies. We saw all the great movies in the late 50s, early 60s. I have a really fond memory of going to the cinema every week and then talking about the films as we walked home afterwards.
You mentioned being an ABC listener. Were you an Argonaut?
I was. Socrates 30.
And what does that mean?
They just used to give you a name. I'm pretty sure. I think I was Socrates 30. Now, I used to listen to that. You know, again, the contribution that program made to cultural lives, if you want to put it that way, of young people, interesting reference points, taking up interesting issues that you could think about. So, yes, I was an Argonaut.
And what about music? Was that ever a feature?
Not really. I mean, music wasn't really part of my family really weren't, and I'm not conscious of there being a lot of music in the house. I used to listen to the local radio station, of course, when they had, you know, the top 10 or the top 30 pop songs. You know, I used to listen to that. But music wasn't a big influence.
And I suppose if you were listening to the local commercial station for the top 10 and top 30, was there much Australian stuff there?
Oh, there was. Growing up, I remember, you'd remember Johnny Young. Ronnie Burns, who's just reappearing, of course. I noticed he's doing a concert. The big debate in WA is you had to line up with Johnny Young because he was the Western Australian, and Ronnie Burns, he was the Eastern Stater. So we used to have those little discussions at playtime. And, of course, the Easy Beats.
So you did mention the movies. In the 50s and 60s, were there still serials playing on the Friday night?
No, what you would get is you'd get the Movie Town News, you know, that started it off, and then you'd get a cartoon, and then you'd get the movie. The Movie Town News, of course, was quite interesting, and as you know, in that great Australian film, which talked about the slow decline of the cameramen, you know, who were going out collecting information and giving those news coverages at the beginnings of the film. TV really knocked them out for six. I do remember them well. I remember the cartoons. But, you know, we saw all of the movies that were, you know, important at the time. I had my favourites. I always liked Tony Curtis. And I was very pleased to read later on that he played quite a significant role in providing support for Jewish people in Czechoslovakia, his background, to remember their culture and etc. So he was my favourite.
My recollection is that Merry-Go-Round Under the Sea was set in Geraldton. Is that correct?
Yes, Randolph Stowe, his family's name was well known to me. He was a local solicitor. And Randolph, of course, wrote that wonderful book, Merry-Go-Round the Sea, which is the classic Geraldton book. The reason I remember it so well is the character in that book. I had an uncle who went off to war and unfortunately came back a very unhappy. You know, his life was tragic. He was an alcoholic and he struggled with life. He was a waterside worker and they tended to look after him there, you know, which was good to see. But the character, of course, comes back from the war and he's not quite the same, the young boy's experience of him. So Merry-Go-Round the Sea means a lot to me. It's a wonderful book. And Randolph Stowe, of course, is the Geraldton writer, I suppose you'd say.
One of a long list of pretty outstanding West Australian writers.
Well, Tim Winton, of course, you think of him at the same time. In fact, you know, in some ways, sort of similar, not totally. Tim Winton, of course, I love his reference to Western Australian life reaches its highest peak where the water meets the land. You know, it's a wonderful image. You know, all these West Australians on the beach and, you know, fishing and swimming and diving and then playing on cricket on the beach and whatever. It's a wonderful image that he creates with that reference.
So I'm guessing, Jeff, speaking to you, that you've got a bit of an emotional attachment with these experiences, these recollections.
Very much. I mean, I feel very strongly about local history. And when I was in Parliament, I did a little history of each one of the suburbs that was in my electorate. And I remember getting a wonderful letter from a senior citizen who'd come to live in the old person's home, as we used to call it, in my electorate. And she said, "Thank you very much for the history of Bentley." She said, "I now feel much more secure knowing the history of the suburb I'm in." And I thought that was a very interesting comment.
You're 67 now, Jeff. You've had a very distinguished career, and yet you're still working. Is your life a good life now?
Yes, I'm doing quite a bit of travelling, but I still work. I get invited to do lectures. I think I've got 7 lectures coming up for the rest of this year. Various topics, some related to philosophy and politics, some related to specific legislative type issues. And I love to spend time preparing. I love writing essays. I love preparing speeches. So I'm capable of saying no if I don't want to do something. At the same time, I've got time to do some travelling, and mixing the travelling and the lecturing together is extremely, I find, very stimulating and very enjoyable.
Well, apart from the obvious drawbacks that come with ageing, do you suppose, Jeff Gallop, that ageing can be fun?
Oh, look, the opportunities in our society now to, you know, when you're working, there are disciplines associated with it. And perhaps, you know, I find now that if I'm reading something and then in the course of reading it, there's an idea in there that I like, I might drop what I'm reading and go off and look at that other idea. But the serendipity of it all is wonderful. And if you don't have other stresses in your life, there's no question that it's the most stimulating way to live. Being retired, choose what you want to do, do reading, follow up ideas, read, you know, keep a close look on what's happening in the world and continue that learning process, which I think is the way we ought to look at life.
And as the master's apprentices sang, do what you want to do, be what you want to be, yeah.
Yeah, right.
So, Jeff Gallop, do you value your social connections? How important are they to you?
I think connectedness is very important. In fact, Hugh Mackay, you know, last couple of books he's written has focused on this, that as individuals we can get so far, but we need contact, you know, we need relationships, we need to be stimulated, we need to learn from others, we need to be with others, we need to have activities with others. And so the self is one thing, but the self and the other is the much better way to look on life generally. I rate it very, very highly. There's nothing that beats an activity where you're sharing the tough bits and the good bits with other people, like politics that I was engaged in for a long time, or where you're being stimulated by the ideas someone's got. Now, it's not all good, of course. Sometimes you might get angry and you've got to cope with the fact that you live in a world of difference. But I was given the task once to give a public lecture on living with difference. It was in the early part of this century. cemetery, so I asked a friend of mine who was an Anglican minister of religion and a friend of mine who was a very senior figure in the Islamic community in Perth, and they both gave the same answer, and it was interesting. They said the key to living with difference is that people of different backgrounds should be working together on a common problem. I thought that was very interesting that both of them said that, and they weren't prompted to say it. So the more we work together on the common problems and bring people of difference together, we all start to realise that we're all really human beings, whether we have our racial background, our cultural background, our national background, we're all really human beings together in trying to make it a better place.
And that goes for us while we age as well.
Exactly. Mm.
And do you get together with your mates for a coffee? How do you socialise? How do you?
Oh, well, when I go back to Perth, I love meeting up with my former colleagues in politics. When I go back to Geraldton, I've got some friends that go way back, and I love to have a chat to them, sharing some of the stories of earlier times. So I've got, you know, the Geraldton connection, I've got the political connection in Perth, and now I've got a whole range of new friends since coming over here to Sydney.
Jeff Gallop, you get the chance as a guest on Nostalgia Town, as do all guests, to nominate a song to go out on. What is your song and why did you choose it?
Well, it has to be Easy Beats, Friday on My Mind. And it's not that I was waiting for Friday, although I was, because I love the weekend sport, but I love school as well. It's just that it was such an important song in the 60s. And the band, of course, too, became a legendary all through Europe. They were young migrants. They came to Australia. There was the Dutch contingent, the Scottish contingent. It really reminds me of the 60s. And whenever I hear it, I think of my days in Geraldton. It brings it all back.
Jeff Gallop, thank you very much for joining us today on Nostalgia Town.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
And now on the Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century, it's time for Out and About, where we find out about some of the things that older people can do in Sydney and in the Inner West. And our guest today on Out and About is Mary Chanter, who is the Healthy Ageing Supervisor with the Inner West Council. How are you today, Mary?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well. And we're coming up to episode 10. So tell us, what's on in the Inner West for older people?
Okay, Jeff. I would like to talk about a free event for women 50 plus and their friends. It's called Wellbeing for Older Women. It's a half-day morning of videos, information, panel discussion and hand massages put on by the Canterbury and Inner West Elder Abuse Collaborative. We'll have a coffee cart, videos, panel discussion with seniors' rights, focusing on financial and emotional and safety issues, a panel of speakers, followed by a free lunch and a chance to have a chat. You can register on Eventbrite or you can call Yumi at the Older Women's Network on 9519 8044. Transport is also available on request, and if people wanted to ring Leanne at Tom Foster Community Centre, 9392 5187. We also have the two cafes for multicultural social gatherings for people with dementia and their carers, Cafe Joya once a month and at George's Kitchen in Marrickville once a month. Cafe Joya is in Leichhardt and it's on the fourth Tuesday of each month from 10:30 to 12, and George's Kitchen is on the second Thursday of the month, 10:30 to 12 noon. We'd particularly like to get more people to those, and they can contact our seniors line on 9392 5863. Council's Live Music Grants is also open for any musicians out there aiming to strengthen the Inner West as Sydney's live music destination. Funding is available under two grant categories. So for musician development grants of up to $5,000 and venue capacity grants. So again, they can check out the website to get more information about that. I'd also like to talk about what's on for the Chrissy Cotter Gallery for Reconciliation Week. Chrissy Cotter is located in Pittick Street, Camperdown. And Noel Butler, who's a Butterwang elder, has got an exhibition that starts on the 23rd of May to the 31st of May. Nura Ganyu is the name of the exhibition, and it will showcase artwork and artefacts on display from 10 till 3 and 10 till 4, actually. 10 till 3 on Fridays, 10 till 4 Thursday through to Sundays. That will be showing. The Marrickville also has a speaker series, the My Age Care Information Sessions in Mandarin, Wednesday the 29th of May 2019 from 10 till 12:30 at the Ashfield Library. We also are very keen to keep doing our Cyber Seniors program, which just has commenced at the Ashfield Boys High and at Kashmir College in Marrickville. We do rotate that between four different high schools in the area, so if anyone is interested, we can put your name down for the next series of Cyber Seniors programs, or in fact link you into one of the Tech Savvy Seniors programs the library's host, and you can contact us on 9392 5863. It's worth checking the What's On pages of Council's website, www.innerwest.newsouthwales.gov.au, and to get a list of everything that's on each day. The Council hosts a variety of different things, and we sometimes publicise also some of the other things that are happening in the local area. As for example, apart from art and, you know, library talks and things that are specific to seniors, there's other fantastic opportunities for creativity and to stimulate the mind. But all the active and connected programs that we have are now available not only online but in a booklet called the Active and Connected Booklet, with over 70 instances of activities, whether it be physical, creative, etc., etc.
Please speak about the film club, Mary.
Yeah, the film club on Friday the 31st of May from 2 till 4 at the Balmain Library. The film is going to be called Kiss Me Deadly, about a doomed female hitchhiker. It's worth checking that out on our website as well, because we do have a film club, and there's a variety of different films that are on different locations across the Inner West.
So, what have you got to tell us about volunteering in the Inner West?
Well, the Healthy Ageing Team, and along with some of our community centres, the Healthy Ageing Team, where I sit, we just have put an ad in the paper, actually, or not in the paper, on the official Volunteering New South Wales website, and considering it in the paper, but we run a whole lot of programs for seniors, and we're very interested in seeing if there's any seniors out there who might like to actually contribute to the coordination of the running of those programs, where people sometimes get together for lunches, and we have different activities that involve talks and going to the schools as well, where the teachers coordinate our older residents who are matched with the students, and sometimes it was nice to sort of be there as well, just to support that process. So there's lots of different volunteers, and we'll be working with the skill base of the seniors themselves. They just need to contact me, really, and we would take it from there.
And your number again, Mary?
9392 5863. There's environmental volunteering as well as LGBTIQ volunteering, all sorts of volunteering that can be offered in the community.
Mary Chanter, Healthy Ageing Supervisor with the Inner West Council, thank you very much for joining us today on Out and About.
Thanks, Jeff.
The Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century is produced in the studios of Radio Skid Row. You can hear this show again weekly on Thursdays at 3 o'clock, or you can listen again online by searching for Radio Skid Row, and you'll find a link in the SoundCloud box to the right. Join us again in a week's time for the next episode, and don't forget to check us out online by going to www.radioskidrow.org and following the links. This production was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. This program is produced with the assistance of Lex Marinos and Raul Hernandez. I'm your host, Jeff Forillo, and I hope you can join us again next week.